Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Business of Madame Jean by Vincent O'Sullivan. How we all stared, how frightened we all were, how we passed opinions on that morning when Gustave Herbout was found swinging by the neck from the ceiling of his bedroom. The whole Faubourg, even the ancient folk who had not felt a street under them for years, turned out and stood gaping at the house with amazement and loud conjecture. For why should Gustave Herbout, of all men, take to the rope? Only last week he had inherited all the money of his aunt, Madame Jean, together with her house and the shop with the 5 assistants, and life looked fair enough for him. No, clearly it was not wise of Gustave to hang himself. Besides, his aunt's death had happened at a time when Gustave was in sore straits for money. To be sure, he had a salary from the bank in which he worked, but what is a mere salary to one who, like Gustave, threw off the clerkly habit when working hours were over to assume the dress and lounge of the accustomed boulevardier, while he would relate to obsequious friends vague but satisfactory stories of a Russian prince who was his uncle and of an extremely rich English lady to whose death he looked forward with hope. Alas, with a clerk's salary, one cannot make much of a figure in Paris. It took all of that and more to maintain the renown he had gained among his acquaintance of having to his own a certain little lady with yellow hair who danced divinely. So he was forced to depend on the presents which Madame Jean gave him from time to time, and for those presents he had to pay his aunt a most sedulous and irksome attention. At times, when he was almost sick from his craving for the boulevard, the café, the theater, he would have to repair, as the day grew to an end, to Alfarberg and the house behind the shop, where he would sit to an old-fashioned supper with his aunt, and listened with a sort of dull impatience while she asked him when he had last been to confession, and told him long, dreary stories of his dead father and mother. Punctually at 9 o'clock, the deaf servant, who was the only person besides Madame Jean that lived in the house, would let in the fat old priest who came for his game of dominoes and betake herself to bed. Then the dominoes would begin, and with them the old man's prattle, which Gustave knew so well, about his daily work, about the uselessness of all things here on earth, and the happiness and glory of the kingdom of heaven. And, of course, our boulevardier noticed, with the usual cheap sneer of the modern, that whilst the priest talked of the kingdom of heaven, he yet shewed the greatest anxiety if he had symptoms of a cold or any other petty malady. However, Gustave would sit there, with a hypocrite's grin and inwardly raging, till the clock chimed 11. At that hour, Madame Jean would rise, and if she was pleased with her nephew, would go over to her writing desk and give him, with a rather pretty air of concealment from the priest, perhaps 50 or 100 francs, whereupon Gustave would bid her a manifestly affectionate good night and depart in the company of the priest. As soon as he could get rid of the priest, he would hasten to his favorite cafes to discover that all the people worth seeing had long since grown tired of waiting and had departed on their own affairs. The money, indeed, was a kind of consolation. But then there were nights when he did not get a sou. Ah, they amused themselves in Paris, but not in this way. This is not amusing. One cannot live a proper life upon a salary and an occasional gift of 50 or 100 francs. It is not entertaining to tell men that your uncle, the prince at Moscow, is in a sorry case and even now lies a-dying, or that the rich English lady is in the grip of a vile consumption and is momently expected to succumb. If these men only shove up their shoulders, wink at one another, and continue to present their bills. Further, the little mademoiselle with yellow hair had lately shown signs of a very pretty temper. because her usual flowers and bonbons were not apparent. So, since things were coming to a dismal pass, Gustave fell to attending the race meetings at Chantilly. During the first week, Gustave won largely, for that is sometimes the way with ignorant men. During that week, too, the little mademoiselle was charming, for she had her bouquets and boxes of bonbons. But the next week, Gustave lost heavily, for that is also very often the way with ignorant men, and he was thrown into the blackest despair. When one night, at a place where he used to sup, mademoiselle took the arm of a great fellow whom he much suspected to be a German, and tossed him a scornful nod as she went off. On the evening after this happened, he was standing between 5 and 6 o'clock in the Place de la Madeleine, blowing on his fingers and trying to plan his next move, when he heard his name called by a familiar voice and turned to face his aunt's advisor, the priest. "Ah, Gustave, my friend, I have just been to see a colleague of mine here," cried the old man, pointing to the great church. "And are you going to your good aunt tonight?" he asked, with a look at Gustave's neat dress. Gustave was in a flame that the priest should have detected him in his gay clothes, for he always made a point of appearing at Madame Jean's clad staidly in black. But he answered pleasantly enough, "No, my father, I'm afraid I can't tonight. You see, I'm a little behind with my office work, and I have to stay at home and catch up." "Well, well," said the priest with a half sigh, "I suppose young men will always be the same. I myself can only be with her till 9 o'clock tonight, because I must see a sick parishioner. But let me give you one bit of advice, my friend," he went on, taking hold of a button on Gustave's coat. "Don't neglect your aunt, for mark my words, one day everything of Madame Jean's will be yours." And the omnibus he was waiting for, happening to swing by at that moment, he departed without another word. Gustave strolled along the Boulevard des Capucines in a study. Yes, it was certain that the house and the shop with the 5 assistants would one day be his, for the priest knew all his aunt's affairs. But how soon would they be his? Madame Jean was now hardly 60. Her mother had lived to be 90. When she was 90, he would be. And meanwhile, what about the numerous bills? What, above all, about the little lady with yellow hair? He paused and struck his heel on the pavement with such force that 2 men passing nudged one another and smiled. Then he made certain purchases and set about wasting his time till 9 o'clock. It is curious to consider that although when he started out at 9 o'clock, Gustave was perfectly clear as to what he meant to do, yet he was chiefly troubled by the fear that the priest had told his aunt about fine clothes. But when he had passed through the deserted Faubourg and had come to the house behind the shop, he found his aunt only very pleased to see him and a little surprised. So he sat with her and listened to her gentle, homely stories and told lies about himself and his manner of life till the clock struck 11. Then he rose, and Madame Jean rose too, and went to her writing desk and opened a small drawer. "You have been very kind to a lonely old woman tonight, my Gustave," said Madame Jean, smiling. "How sweet of you to say that, dearest aunt," replied Gustave. He went over and passed his arm caressingly across her shoulders and stabbed her in the heart. For a full 5 minutes after the murder, he stood still, as men often do in a great crisis when they know that any movement means decisive action. Then he started, laid hold of his hat, and made for the door. But there the stinging knowledge of his crime came to him for the first time, and he turned back into the room. Madame Jean's bedroom candle was on a table. He lit it and passed through the door which led from the house into the shop, crouching below the counters covered with white sheets, lest a streak of light on the windows might attract the observation of some passenger. He proceeded to a side entrance to the shop, unbarred and unlocked the door, and put the key in his pocket. Then, in the same crouching way, he returned to the room and started to ransack the small drawer. The notes he scattered about the floor, but 2 small bags of coins went into his coat. Then he took the candle and dropped some wax on the face and hands and dress of the corpse. He spilt wax too over the carpet, and then he broke the candle and ground it under his foot. He even tore with long nervous fingers at the dead woman's bodice until her breast lay exposed, and plucked out a handful of her hair and threw it on the floor to stick to the wax. When all these things had been accomplished, he went to the house door and listened. The Faubourg is always very quiet about 12 o'clock, and a single footstep falls on the night with a great sound. He could not hear the least noise, so he darted out and ran lightly until he came to a turning. There he fell into a sauntering walk, lit a cigarette, and hailing a passing fiacre, directed the man to drive to the Pont Saint-Michel. At the bridge, he alighted, and noting that he was not eyed, he threw the key of the shop into the river. Then, assuming the swagger and assurance of a half-drunken man, he marched up the boulevard and entered the Café de Harcourt. The place was filled with the usual crowd of men and women of the Quartier Latin. Gustave looked around, and observing a young student with a flushed face who was talking eagerly about the rights of man, he sat down by him. It was his part to act quickly, so before the student had quite finished a sentence for his ear, the murderer gave him the lie. The student, however, was not so ready for a fight as Gustave had supposed, and when he began to argue again, Gustave seized a glass full of brandy and water and threw the stuff in his face. Then indeed there was a row, till the gendarme interfered and hauled Gustave to the station. At the police station he bitterly lamented his misdeed, which he attributed to an extra glass of absinthe, and he begged the authorities to carry word of his plight to his good aunt, Madame Jean, in our Faubourg. So to the house behind the shop they went, and there they found her, sitting with her breast hanging out, her poor head clotted with blood, and a knife in her heart. The next morning Gustave was set free. A man and a woman, two of the five assistants in the shop, had been charged with the murder. The woman had been severely reprimanded by Madame Jean on the day before, and the man was known to be the girl's paramour. It was the duty of the man to close at night all the entrances into the shop, save the main entrance, which was closed by Madame Jean and her deaf servant, and the police had formed a theory, working out with the amazing zeal and skill which caused the Paris police so often to overreach themselves, that the man had failed to bolt one of the side doors, and had by his subtlety got possession of the key whereby he and his accomplice re-entered the place about midnight. Working on this theory, the police had woven a web round the two unfortunates with threads of steel, and there was little doubt that both of them would stretch their necks under the guillotine, with full consent of press and public. At least this was Gustave's opinion, and Gustave's opinion now went for a great deal in the Faubourg. Of course, there were a few who murmured that it was a good thing poor Madame Jean had not lived to see her nephew arrested for a drunken brawler, but with full remembrance of who owned the shop and the house, we were most of us inclined to say after the priest that if the brave Gustave had been with his aunt, the shocking affair could never have occurred. And indeed, what had we more inspiring than the inconsolable grief he showed? Why, on the day of the funeral, when he heard the earth clatter down on the coffin lid in Père Lachaise, he even swooned to the ground and had to be carried out in the midst of mourners. Oh yes, quoth the gossips, Gustave Herbout loved his aunt passing well. On the night after the funeral, Gustave was sitting alone before the fire in Madame Jean's room, smoking and making his plans. He thought that when all this wretched mock grief and pretense of decorum was over, he would again visit the cafes, which he greatly savored, and the little mademoiselle with yellow hair would once more smile on him, delicious smiles, with a gleaming regard. Thus, he was thinking when the clock on the mantelpiece tinkled 11, and at that moment a very singular thing happened. The door was suddenly opened. A girl came in and walked straight over to the writing desk, pulled out the small drawer, and then sat staring at the man by the fire. She was distinctly beautiful, although there was a certain old-fashionedness in her peculiar silken dress and the manner of wearing her hair. Not once did it occur to Gustave, as he gazed in terror, that he was gazing on a mortal woman. The doors were too well bolted to allow anyone from outside to enter. And besides, there was a strange, baffling familiarity in the face and mien of the intruder. It might have been an hour as he sat there, and then the silence became too horrible. By a supreme effort of his wonderful courage, he rushed out of the room and upstairs to get his hat. There, in his murdered aunt's bedroom, there smiling at him from the wall, was a vivid presentment of the dread vision that sat below, a portrait of Madame Jean as a girl. He fled into the street and walked, perhaps 2 miles, before he thought at all. But when he did think, he found that he was drawn again, says Will, back to the house to see if it was still there, just as the police believed the murderer is drawn to the morgue to view the body of his victim. Yes, the girl was there still, with her great reproachless eyes, and throughout that solemn night, Gustave, haggard and mute, sat glaring at her. Towards dawn, he fell into an uneasy doze, and when he awoke with a scream, he found that the girl was gone. At noon the next day, Gustave heartened by several glasses of brandy and cheered by the sunshine in the Champs-Élysées, endeavored to make light of the affair. He would gladly have arranged not to go home to the house, but then people would talk so much, and he could not afford to lose any custom out of the shop. Moreover, the whole matter was only a hallucination, the effect of jaded nerves. He dined well and went to see a musical comedy, and so contrived that he did not return to the house until after 2 o'clock. There was someone waiting for him, sitting at the desk, with a small drawer open. Not the girl of last night, but a somewhat older woman, and the same reproachless eyes. So great was the fascination of those eyes that, although he left the house at once, with an iron resolution not to go back, he found himself drawn under them again, and he sat through the night as he had sat through the night before, sobbing and stupidly glaring. And all day long he crouched by the fire shuddering, and all the night till 11 o'clock, and then a figure of his aunt came to him again, but always a little older and more withered. And this went on for 5 days, the figure that sat with him becoming older and older as the days ran, till on the sixth night he gazed through the hours at his aunt, as she was on the night he killed her. On these nights he was used sometimes to start up and make for the street, swearing never to return, but always he would be dragged back to the eyes. The policemen came to know him from these night walks, and people began to notice his bad looks. These could not spring from grief, folks said, so they thought he was leading a wild life. On the seventh night, there was a delay of about 5 minutes after the clock had rung 11 before the door opened. And then, merciful God, the body of a woman in grave clothes came into the room, as if borne by unseen men, and lay in the air across the writing desk, while a small drawer flew open of its own accord. Yes, there was the shroud of the brown scapular, the prim white cap, the hands folded on the shrunken breast. Gray from slimy horror, Gustav raised himself up and went over to look for the eyes. When he saw them pressed down with pennies, he reeled back and vomited into the grate, and blind and sick and loathing, he stumbled upstairs. But as he passed Madame Jean's bedroom, the corpse came out to meet him, with the eyes closed and the pennies pressing them down. Then at last, reeking and dabbled with sweat, with his tongue lolling out and the spittle running down his beard, Gustav breathed, "Are you alive?" "No, no," wailed the thing with a burst of awful weeping. "I have been dead many days." Carnivorine by Lucy H. Hooper. When I, Ellis Graham, being a man of middle age, means, and leisure, determined upon starting last autumn for Rome with a view to studying up the localities for my projected history of the Cenci family, I never expected assuredly that a momentous and important task regarding other people's affairs and not my own should be imposed upon me. Yet I could not well refuse the mission. I had known the Lambert family for many years, and had always cherished a warm friendship for Mr. and Mrs. Lambert, a friendship which, after the demise of the former, I had continued to his widow. And Julius, the elder son, had been quite a favorite of mine in his boyish days, though I could not altogether sympathize with his craze for scientific pursuits, and especially for botany. It must be confessed, however, that his researches into the formation and functions of the vegetable kingdom had led to some curious discoveries. But these discoveries had only served to arouse in his mind, as he grew into manhood, a wild ambition for further successes in the same line. I never exactly comprehended what course his investigation had taken, but I knew he was deeply interested in the Darwinian theories, and had set himself in that connection some inscrutable problem that he was trying to make out. He lived such a secluded life, shut up with his plants and his theories, that I had wholly lost sight of him for some years, though my visits to Mrs. Lambert were still continued. I was a good deal surprised, however, on the eve of my departure for Europe, to receive from my old friend a few hurried lines, begging that I would call to see her before I left, and fixing the very next evening for my visit. I responded to the appeal and found the usually serene and dignified lady in a state of unwonted emotion. "I've sent for you, dear Mr. Graham," she said, "to ask if you will undertake for me a very important mission. It is hardly right, I know, for me to make such a request of you, involving, as your consent will surely do, a good deal of trouble and the loss of a considerable portion of your time. But my peace of mind is at stake, and I do not know what else to do if you are not willing to help me." Anything that is in my power to execute, dear Mrs. Lambert, I will gladly undertake, I answered. And indeed, I was so much moved by her distress, and by noticing the traces left upon her still fair features by wearing anxiety, that I was ready to promise anything or to undertake anything in her behalf. I want you to find Julius for me. Julius? Is he absent from home? I did not even know that he had gone away. Yes, he sailed for Europe 3 years ago. You know, his uncle left him a handsome fortune a little before that time, and he went abroad to pursue, as he stated, his scientific experiments. I know that he believed himself to be on the verge of a great discovery, but of what nature that discovery was, he never would reveal, even to me. As you may remember, I have never sympathized with him in his studies, so I suppose he did not consider me worthy of his confidence. Perhaps I did wrong. Maybe if I had interested myself more in his pursuits, but he would not have left me as he had done. He told me before he went away that his experiments must be perfected in thorough seclusion, and that he never meant to relinquish them till he had arrived at some great result. We heard from him afterward at Paris and later on at Milan, but he's not written to his brothers or to me for months. Have you no idea as to his whereabouts at present? I have reason to think that he has taken up his abode somewhere in the neighborhood of Rome. He was seen there 2 winters ago by Alan Spencer, the artist, who had quite a talk with him, but who could not find out anything from him respecting his residence or his pursuits. Did he seem well? He looked tired and haggard, Mr. Spencer said, but was otherwise well. The reason for my anxiety is, I might as well confess it to you at once. I fear that there is some entanglement in the case. A passion for some woman who may entrap Julius into matrimony. And have you any foundation for this dread? Only this. He let fall something to Mr. Spencer about a personage called Carnivorine. What an extraordinary name. Did he give his friend any information concerning her? No. He was singularly reticent on the subject and seemed really distressed at having let even her name slip out unawares. He requested Mr. Spencer never to mention it, but Alan has always been on very intimate terms with Richard and Maud, and seeing how uneasy we were at Julius' long silence, he did not hesitate, not having made any promise of secrecy, to tell us the little that he knew. So when you reach Rome, if you will try to find our lost Julius for us, I shall be more indebted to you than I can well tell you. I promise to do my best, and Mrs. Lambert, visibly relieved, added some details about her son's banker in Rome, and also respecting the few persons that he knew in that city, and who might have learned something concerning him during the last few months. Also, she gave me the name and address of the herbalist before whose door, and indeed issuing from it, Alan Spencer had met Julius in such an unexpected fashion. "You will write to me as soon as you have any news," she said, wistfully to me at parting. "And above all, let me know everything you can find out about Carnivorine. Do not hesitate to tell me the worst, even if Julius has married this creature with a singular name." I must confess that, when I first arrived in Rome, so many personal interests claimed me that I did not at once begin my search for Julius Lambert as I had intended to do. There were so many of my friends and old haunts to revisit, and such numbers of new and interesting statues in the studios of the Roman sculptors, both native and foreign, to go to see in my negotiations with the artists who were to execute the illustrations from my history of the Cenci family, took up so much time that the weeks insensibly slipped away before I had taken any steps in the matter. I had had the time to receive more than one letter from Mrs. Lambert on the subject before I commenced my investigations. I must acknowledge that I had come to the conclusion that the mystery on investigation would prove to be no mystery at all, and that Julius would be discovered in one of the minor hotels in Rome, too busy or perhaps too much in love to write. But when I did finally set out in search of him, I found myself baffled at the very outset by an impenetrable wall of mystery. Nobody had seen him, and nobody knew anything about him. He had drawn all his funds from the bankers on his first arrival in the city. He had been in Rome some 2 years before and had bought a collection of the curious insect-eating plants of South America from the old herbalist at whose door Alan Spencer had met him. That was all. If the earth had opened beneath his feet and had swallowed him up, he could not have vanished more utterly from human ken. I sought for him in every direction. I employed the services of a private detective. I offered a reward for any news of him. All was of no use. I succeeded in learning that he had not left Rome, and that was all I could find out. Some months had elapsed, and I had pretty much abandoned the search in despair, when one day the fancy took me to go on a ride on horseback over the Campania. I had long cherished the desire to explore the less frequented and scarcely known districts of the vast region, haunted by malaria and tenanted only by a few fever-stricken shepherds, that lies outside the beaten track of tourists and travelers beyond the city walls. As may be imagined, I found my excursion rather dreary. I rode on and on, passing now a flock of sheep watched over by a brigand-looking guardian and a fierce, rough dog that looked ready at a word or a sign from his master to tear down my horse and throttle its rider, and then some huge arch of a ruined aqueduct that in the days of classic Rome had been musical with laughing water. Sometimes I came upon the shattered fragments of an abandoned hovel, or met with a herd of the great-coated, long-horned oxen of the region, beautiful, placid-looking creatures that gazed at me inquiringly out of their large, soft eyes as I rode by, as though saying, "What is this stranger doing in this home of solitude and ruin?" Still, I was interested by the very novelty of that dreary region, and I rode on and on till the sun began to sink toward the western horizon. I have always considered myself fever-proof, but all the same, a ride after sunset over the Campania is not the healthiest experiment in the world. So I wheeled my horse around and started to return to the city. And as I did so, I became aware of the existence of a house at a very short distance. I might very well have passed it without noticing it, as it was so embowered in a mass of vegetation, vines and bushes as well as trees, that its shape and architecture were barely discernible. As I rode nearer, I saw that it was a modern villa of imposing dimensions, which had been suffered to fall into almost total ruin. Whether the freak of a speculator or the wild idea of some Campania proprietor had caused the erection in this lonely, unhealthy place of a costly country residence, there was no evidence to reveal. The grounds, once spacious and well laid out, were overrun with a thick undergrowth of plants and grasses. Here and there a statue in white marble, streaked with damp and green with mold, showed under the shadow of the trees, and one, a graceful figure of a nymph, overthrown from its pedestal, lay prostrate among the rank grass. The facade of the house itself was adorned with moss-grown sculptures, and one of the pillars supporting the doorway had been broken away, and its place was supplied by the trunk of a cypress. One half of the building showed deserted and ruinous, with its broken windows and decaying roof, but there were traces elsewhere of human habitation. The roof of the right wing had been mended, the windows were in good condition, and a gleam of firelight from the lower rooms gave a cheery aspect to that part of the edifice. And oddly enough, in spite of the universal decay and dilapidation, there were traces not only of comfort but of luxury in one portion of the premises, which I noticed as I drew near. This was a large conservatory adjoining the inhabited portion of the house. It was in perfect order. Not a pane was missing in its glazed walls, through which I could discern the red glare of the stove fires within, as well as the dull green of the foliage of the plants. Both I and my horse were weary, so I decided that I would halt for an hour or so at this singular habitation and try for a feed of oats for my horse, as well as for a flask of Chianti and a crust of bread for myself. I drew rein at the dilapidated doorway, and just as I was about to announce my presence by a resounding knock from the butt end of my riding whip, the door was suddenly opened and a man came hurriedly forth. He started when he saw me and was about to retreat into the house, but by the red light of the waning sunset, I discerned his features and recognized him instantly. It was the man I had so long sought in vain. It was Julius Lambert. "Julius!" I cried, as he was about to vanish through the doorway. "Julius Lambert! Is it thus that you treat an old friend who has come so far to visit you?" He turned back at the sound of my voice. "So it is really you, Mr. Graham," he said, hesitatingly. "How in the world did you ever find me or the Villa Anzieri? Nobody has come near it, or me either, for over 2 years past. But come in, my man shall take charge of your horse, and you can tell me something about home matters." I willingly relinquished the charge of my wearied steed to the black-eyed, bronze-complexioned, picturesque-looking young fellow, who came in answer to his master's call, and I followed Julius into the house. I could hardly believe my senses when I had found my missing friend at last. It all had happened so simply and yet so strangely. Meanwhile, Julius, after he had gotten over the first shock of my intrusion, seemed really glad to see me. He piled fresh wood on the fire and gave orders that dinner should be served as soon as possible, and he plied me with questions respecting his mother and his brother and his sisters. As for him, I found him looking far from well. He was never very stout, but he had grown lean and emaciated, and the yellowish pallor of his face gave evidence of the effects that the malaria of the Campania had on his system. Dinner was served at last, a very palatable stew, flavored with red peppers and tomatoes, with the accompaniment of some fine oranges and grapes by way of dessert, and a flask or two of Chianti wine and one of the delicate Civita Lavinia. Throughout the repast, I noticed with pain that Julius talked in a feverish, incoherent way, pressing me to eat or to drink, and hurrying questions and remarks about home matters, half the time without waiting for an answer. At last, pushing my plate aside, I remarked, "Now, Julius, I have told you everything that you wish to know. It is my turn now to ask for a little information. What have you been doing all this long time in this solitude?" He moved uneasily in his chair, and his wandering glance avoided mine. "Nothing," he muttered. I am doing nothing." "Nonsense. You cannot persuade me of the truth of that assertion. So ardent an experimentalist as you have always been, and so interested in the cause of science. Confess now. Have you not made, or are you not on the verge of perfecting, some great discovery?" I touched the right chord. His eyes flashed and his whole countenance grew bright with animation. "Yes," he cried, "I have succeeded at last in my researches. For years I have tried to perfect a demonstration of the link between the vegetable and the animal kingdom. If you have come to scoff at my discoveries, go at once. Otherwise, follow me and be prepared for full conviction as to the truth of what I have said." He rose as he spoke, and taking me by the hand, he led me to a door at the extremity of the large room in which we had dined. This door he unlocked with a key which he took from his pocket. Night had closed in, and he completed his preparation by lighting a great torch of pine branches. "Wait on the threshold as you value your life," he said to me impressively. Then he threw open the door. It was the entrance to the conservatory. The first thing that struck me was a sort of faint rustling sound like that garments or sweeping bird's wing. Then by the light of the torch, which Julius held on high, I discerned in the center of the room a vast tub filled with masses of spongy moss, from which rose a strange plant, a hideous shapeless monster, a sort of vegetable hydra, or rather octopus, gigantic in size and repulsive in aspect and in coloring. So immense were its proportions that it filled by itself the whole space of the conservatory. It consisted of a central bladder-shaped trunk or core from which sprang countless branches, or rather arms, thick leafless of a livid green and streaked with blotches of a dull crimson. Each arm terminated in an oval protuberance, which had a resemblance to the human eye. Julius took from a basket that stood near the door a great slice of raw meat, and fastening it to the end of a stick, he advanced it, taking infinite precautions to keep well out of each within the circle of outstretched branches. Then I saw these great tentacle-like arms fold around their prey, which they transmitted to the central core, and then closing around it, I saw it no more. It was the slow motion of the branches that had caused the rustling sound which had amazed me on my first entrance. So repulsive was the aspect of this enormous creature, half plant and half animal, that I was glad to beat a retreat to the dining room. Julius followed, flushed and elated at the beautiful aspect of his monstrous creation. "The plant you have just seen," he said, "is a Drosera, which by dint of careful selection and persevering attention, I have developed into this unheard-of size. I have studied the theories and discoveries of Warming and of Darwin concerning those strange plants, the Drosera and the Dionysia, which though still vegetables feed on the insects that they kill. It has been my desire for years to perfect the missing link and to develop the animal side of these curious vegetable natures. It has always been my theory that the Hydra, the dragon, and other monstrous forms of animal life really did exist, and that in the evolution of ages and by reason of geological changes on the surface of the earth, These creatures, deprived of their accustomed forms of nourishment, degenerated into trees and plants and took roots in the earth. Some of them still preserve their primitive forms, as witnessed the dragon tree of Java. It has been my aim and endeavor to resuscitate the animal and the plant. Chance threw in my way a Drosera of great size. I've fed it on animal food for years, and it developed into something that is not yet a dragon or a hydra, but which is surely something more than a plant. Had you ventured within reach of its branches, the grasp of a boa would not have been more swift or more deadly. And what further do you propose doing with your dreadful plant? My aim now is to give it locomotion, to see it detach itself from the soil and go forth in search of prey. How can you contemplate the possibility of letting loose such a monster on the world? For science, there is no such thing as a monster. Moreover, are there not crocodiles and anacondas and tigers upon earth, to say nothing of the shark and the octopus? Beside these, my creation, my carnivorine, is a harmless creature. I started as I heard the name. So this, then, was the object of my four friends' affection, this ghastly shape, not yet woolly animal, yet scarcely vegetable, with the form of a plant and the appetites of a beast of prey. Just then Pietro, the manservant, came in to announce that my horse was at the door. It was a moonlight night, promising a pleasant ride to the city. I took my leave of Julius, therefore, with something of the feeling of relief of a man who awakes from sleep after having been oppressed by a terrible nightmare. But I did not depart without leaving my address, and I begged Julius to let me know if his strange discovery took any new developments in the near future. Weeks passed, and I had nearly forgotten all about Julius and Carnivorine, when one day I received a letter from him, written in a strain of great exultation and excitement. "Come to me, dear friend," he wrote, "come at once. The hour of the perfecting of my experiment is at hand. Already amid the masses that surround Carnivorine, I discovered disturbing and striving of the roots that are acquiring powers of independent locomotion. In a few days, the problem will be solved. I want you to be present as a witness of the phenomena. My ambition is satisfied at last. My name shall be inscribed on the list of the great discoverers of the world of science. Come to me and be at my side in the moment of my triumph." It was not without difficulty that I once more made my way to the Via Anziera. It was late in the afternoon when I drew rein at the dilapidated doorway that I remembered so well. I knocked loudly at the door, but there was no response to my call. Looking around, I saw that the whole place wore an inexplicable air of desertion. No firelight was visible at the windows, and the red glare of the stove fire no longer shone beyond the dim panes of the hothouse. Finally, in vague alarm, finding that my shouts and knocking produced no response, I tied my horse to one of the doorposts, and singling out a window of the large room in which we had dined on the occasion of my former visit, I swung myself up to it by the help of a thick stem of ivy and peered into the room. The sight that I beheld within froze my soul with horror. At the end of the room, near the entrance to the conservatory, rose the hideous form of Carnivorine, no longer planted in a tub, but supported on what seemed to me a pair of paddle-like feet or paws, like those of some misshapen antediluvian animal. The powerful branches, or rather tentacles, were upraised and closed around some central object, and at the summit of these livid green, closely pressed serpent-like stems appeared a ghastly object. It was a livid human head, the head of a corpse, and the pallid features were those of Julius Lambert. With one stroke of my arm, I burst open the casement. I sprang into the room and hastened toward the dreadful object. The long arms quivered and began to unfold themselves. But before the creature could put itself in motion, a shot from the revolver that I always carried during my Campania wanderings pierced its central core. The tentacles fell apart, and the hideous plant sank prone upon the ground, bearing with it in its fall the crushed and lifeless form of Julius Lambert. A stream of reddish sap that looked like blood flowed from the shattered stem and mingled with the branches, stained as they were with a ruddier crimson, the lifeblood of my unhappy friend. I never discovered how or when the catastrophe took place. From the condition of the body, death must have taken place at least 24 hours before my arrival. The servants brought face to face with such a shocking and to them inexplicable catastrophe had fled from the house, taking with them whatever money or valuables they could lay their hands upon. I tried to retrace them, but in vain. As to the rest, it was all mere conjecture on my part. The uptorn earth and mosses in the tub in which Carnivorine had originally found an abode seemed to prove that a sudden development of the long-sought-for powers of locomotion in the creature had unexpectedly taken place, and that Julius had been seized either in the act of inspecting its conditions or at the moment of offering it food. At all events, the vegetable animal or animal vegetable had made a solitary trial of its newly formed powers and had found a solitary prey when the bullet from my pistol put an end to its existence. Among the papers left behind by Julius was a series of memoranda respecting the experiments he had tried and the processes he had used to bring his dread creation to full perfection. These I destroyed without hesitation. It would not have been well to have suffered the race of the vegetable octopus to be extended and propagated by curious scientists in the future. Then, lest a new growth should spring from the stem of branches of the accursed tree, I hewed them to pieces with my own hand and burned the fragments to ashes. The annihilation of my friend's discovery may be lost to science, but humanity will only have cause to rejoice in the total destruction of Carnivorine.